During a recent gathering of community radio producers for the National Community Radio Conference in Ottawa, community and campus producers were invited to share experiences and discuss gender equality and women's rights in the Canadian and international media landscape in a roundtable discussion with Executive Director of UN Women, Fumzile Mlambo Ngoka. Ms. Ngoka was also in Ottawa at the time to meet with Prime Minister Trudeau and other Canadian officials. She offered us the opportunity to meet and discuss community radio and social justice issues we face here in Canada. UN Women, as an organization, is very interested in global issues regarding gender equality, including the economic empowerment of women and girls, ending violence against women, health issues such as Zika, and engaging constituencies such as men and boys, the private sector, and youth in the fight for gender equality. According to the Canadian Women's Foundation, reports are in Canada that homicide is the number one killer of women in the workplace. 1 in 10 women aged 18 to 24 report having experienced sexual harassment at work within the previous year, and Indigenous women are 3 times more likely to report being the victim of a violent crime. On behalf of the producers and participants, we hope you enjoy this conversation and find strength and inspiration by hearing about the many diverse experiences and perspectives featured here.
I am Phumzile Mlambo Ngoka, Executive Director of UN Women. Glad to be here both to learn and to share about the important work and role of community radio stations.
Ani Bojo Tanse Mishin Dengue Anquad Quindish Nakaz. My name is Gabrielle Fant, originally from Alberta, and I live here in Ottawa, which is on unceded, unsurrendered Algonquin territory. And I help host Machif Hour, which is part of the Aboriginal CKCU programming at Carleton University. So I'm very grateful to be here today. So miigwech, hi for having me.
Hello, my name is Sarah Newton. I'm the acting vice president of the NCRA NREC currently, and I take it for granted a little bit in the community radio sector in Canada. We have a gender neutral and gender balanced board of directors and have for some time now. I got my start in broadcasting on a women's radio collective, which is exciting, but I'm also eager to participate today because I think there's a long distance we can travel still, and I'm looking forward to highlighting some of those issues and as well as hearing about your work around the world. Welcome.
And my name's Gretchen. I'm teching today's show. I'm also been an activist in the community radio sector for more than 15 years and actually came to my first National Campus Community Radio Conference, which opens this week in Ottawa, more than 10 years ago to participate in a Women in Radio track. I work today for the Community Media Advocacy Center, which works for Indigenous and community media in Canada. I also am a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Ottawa, where I'm researching equity in newsrooms, also building on my PhD research, which was on community radio measurements and looking at the impacts of the work that we do.
My name is Nikki, and I also am part of the staff here on CHUO. I'm the resource development coordinator, so I work in a lot of the marketing, promotion, social media, and partnerships that we have here at CHUO. I also host a two-hour show called Radioactive with Nikki, so I'm really excited to delve into this conversation and discuss the equality of women in this sector. My first question for you, Phumzile, would be to ask, what was your interest in interviewing us as radio broadcasters?
Probably not so much to interview than to have a conversation, because in many countries, the mainstream broadcasters are not really focused on empowering women and addressing the issues that are dear to women. And community radio stations have been pioneers in identifying issues that are key to communities. And because you are younger people, you are the new generation of community radio broadcasters, we are keen to learn from your experiences how you're pushing the frontiers. If you were in our position, what are some of the issues that you'd be putting on the table? So I'm not here as an expert. I'm really here to learn from your experiences, which I think are quite dynamic and different from those of people of my age group.
Your answer really opens us up to a lot of dialogue. And one thing that's been on my mind as an Indigenous person is here on Turtle Island, before settlers arrived on Turtle Island, we didn't just have two gender roles. We didn't just have male or woman. Some communities had up to 13 different genders. In our languages today, many indigenous languages, they don't have male or female. Those are things that have evolved after colonization. My curiosity is about how can we include Two-Spirit people? How can we include people that are trans, people that don't necessarily identify as women? How can we include them in the conversation?
I don't think that there's one answer to this, but the one part of the answer is respect for everybody, irrespective of what both their choices and preferences are, and making sure that through our informal and community education, through our parenting, we visually demonstrate the need for that respect and acceptance. In many traditional communities, people used stories to ensure that there is inclusivity. They also, in many communities, if I think about communities in Africa, for instance, celebrations, special occasions where different people are given an opportunity in dance, in music, in song, in food, you get to celebrate the variety that is there in communities. And I think the more we open ourselves to make culture a rich part of our heritage, whatever society you come from, we create an opportunity for everybody to belong. In some communities, age is revered. That's part of being inclusive. When you have people that have got exceptional talent, you sit around and you marvel. That's part of affirming them. But also when you have got people who've got limitation, it could be a disability, you create an opportunity to cherish that. When you have people that are able to, I think in the modern language you'd say, it is a tomboy, or people who have just multiple talent that you cannot say this is a boy or a girl, or you create a special way of celebrating that. And I think that was a way in which traditionally our societies were able to do that. And I think we've got to find a way of fusing that in modern society where we have to fill in forms. Are you men or women? What's your race? What's your gender? And that really boxes everybody into a very limited space.
I guess my other question would be, why do you think in the 21st century is there still so much inequality among men and women?
I think there's intersecting challenges that women and communities face. Women are discriminated, firstly, because they're girls in many communities, because they are indigenous, because they are rural, because they are stay-home moms, because of race. Which cuts across and is visible in so many countries, developed and underdeveloped. A combination of all of those challenges creates a situation where women in almost all societies face discrimination. If they go to work, they will be underpaid. The fact that the global average pay gap is 24%, and that is true of the richest and the poorest countries. Why is it that you find this in every country, irrespective of their level of development or whether they have a constitution that enshrines gender equality? It is because prejudice is so deep. So you still find this inequality everywhere, because even if you've got laws, you've got education, you've got laws that support equality, the prejudice that is within in society is very deep. And when we reviewed the 20 years of implementing the Beijing platform, one thing that we discovered was that in our vigorous implementation of that important agreement, we did not do enough to address directly prejudice and norms that reinforce gender inequality. We passed good laws, but we did not remove bad practice.
I wanted to address that in the Canadian context, because I think the issues that you raise globally are very much reflected here, especially when you think of the context that was raised by Gabrielle in terms of the colonial history of Canada, but also a colonial history that's rooted in anti-blackness, and that white supremacist historical founding of Canada has so many repercussions today. So when we think about women in the workplace and equity in the numbers that have been achieved, we don't necessarily have the measures in place to document what the experiences have been. Are those women in managerial roles? Are they in senior positions? For example, we have a campus community radio sector that 10 plus years ago we did some research, but there's been no follow-up research to say, have stations actually implemented FemCon, which is supposed to highlight femme artists, women-identified artists in Canada? There's a gender equity toolkit. Has it been used? Is it being used? What's been the impact of it? Where it's been applied in the campus community radio sector? So we don't have that data. In addition to that, where data does come through, it speaks to the lack of participation of women, especially when you think of the Canadian Communication, Television and Telecommunication Commission, which regulates radio in Canada. There's been some few, 26% of women appointed to that commission, and there's only been one chair of that commission, so the one that kind of runs the whole thing, the CEO of the CRTC, in its history since 1968, only one woman. Now, only one Indigenous representative has ever been appointed. Very few people of color have been appointed. The fact is that Canada still maintains in the media landscape centers of white power, and where there are women participating, it's white women like me. From your global experience, what have you seen in terms of the effectiveness of these mandates for gender equality when they're not followed up by evaluative practices or by policy that's informed by evaluative practices? It's one thing to pass a policy. It's another thing to put that policy into real action.
I hope that you didn't mind if I also invite my colleagues who are here with me. I have my head of policy, who's an expert in some of the issues that we're discussing, also to contribute. But let me start by saying, when it comes into securing a place for people who are excluded, there is nothing like policy where there's repercussions for non-implementing. People do not voluntarily include people in cultures where there's deep history of exclusion. Laws will not make the people that have an attitude that exclude others to love the people that they want to exclude, but it could force them to do something they don't want to do because there's repercussions. And that is why quota systems in many countries where we have seen increase in the inclusion of people that would otherwise be included work. So where you have produced a report, where you have made strong suggestions about what needs to be done, where you have passed policy, I think it's important to have implemented quotas reinforced by recourse when the law is not being followed. Otherwise, depending on the goodness of people's heart, lets us down so often. I see it in many countries, and I think what you're explaining about Canada is very much similar to what you see in other countries. But when it comes into the world of broadcasting, where sometimes the written word has so much strength, sometimes over oral traditions, the radio fraternity has a particular role to play by bringing the stories of the people who don't have to read and write for their stories to be heard. That probably requires a dedicated choice to make that one way to fight the battle. But also, in this world of television and that kind of visual arts and form of communication, there's a lot of glamour that is associated with that, which starts by thinking that if you bring in a grassroots perspective into that world, it is not interesting enough. And we have to do battle against that, because that is also what determines whose presence is valued, who brings audience, and we get into, you know, viewership and all of that. And then as we do that, we actually include other people's authentic stories and histories. I've seen that in Brazil, country where the majority of the population is actually people of African descent. But when you look at who dominates the media, the visual and otherwise, you really see sprinkles of black people. It is only in those stations where people actually have made it a policy, given a quota and following up. Think of a country like South Africa, my country. We are a majority black country, but we have, for instance, music and content that comes from all over the world that has drowned local content. We have had to pass a law to actually secure a percentage for locally produced content in order to make sure that we do not subsume. And there's consequence for DJs, for presenters, for the head of station if they actually don't do that. So law must have teeth. I think that's the moral of the story. Laws must have teeth.
If I'm being completely real, sometimes I can be sitting in my office, and if, let's say, somebody who has never been to the station, who has never met any staff member, will walk into the main office, and they may see a black woman, a white male, and a white female, they will automatically first gravitate to the white male, whether or not they know if that is who they need for the request that they are asking or not. The second person they will gravitate to is the white female. The last person they will come to is me. That's just the reality, and that's just what I've seen. We say that we want to get rid of the stereotypes and we want to get rid of the quote-unquote norms. But I feel, and this would be my question for you also, that people are comfortable in their stereotype. Just at the basic level, you will say to the man, you take out the trash, I'll do the dishes. Or these are too heavy for me, or something like that. Just at the basic level, subconsciously, we are comfortable with these stereotypes. My question would be, how do we deconstruct the comfort?
That's where Poona comes in.
My name's Poona Sen, I'm Director of Policy at UN Women. I think this conversation is really, really important, and I'll tell you why I think it's really timely. In essence, it's way overdue, but I think there's a frame in the world now and that governments have committed to that is really important for us. I just want to acknowledge that, and then I want to come to the specifics. Last September, governments from across the world agreed a whole new set of objectives that they would try and reach for women and for everybody else, and that includes a commitment to leave nobody behind. If we're really going to leave nobody behind, these conversations about who have been left behind and why is absolutely crucial. There is the whole issue you've raised around Indigenous women, around race and black women. ED has mentioned about women with disabilities and older women. This is not just an opportunity, but an absolute obligation on states and governments now to address those histories which have been exclusionary. But it means we have to do some of the uncomfortable things about unpicking what people are comfortable with and challenging them on that, which is always, always very disruptive and difficult to do. And it meets a massive backlash and resistance. So what you're asking everybody to do is something that a lot of people are going to be very uncomfortable with. But I think we still have to do it. I think we absolutely have to do it. And ensuring that we have the voices of Indigenous women and black women saying what their real experience is crucial. In a way, you don't get things to shift unless people are brave and say that. And being brave is a big step because there are always consequences. If you know you're the black woman who says you're always ignoring me, you know that people are going to say you're just whinging or you're complaining. But you have to know now that there is a commitment, an obligation on states and activists and broadcasts and everybody else have to hold them to account on making this difference. And they're really ambitious about when they say they're going to make it all change, which is another 14 years. So make people uncomfortable. One of our colleagues, your deputy, Lakshmi Puri, talks about our task is disrupting the universe. And that's absolutely right. It's that scale of ambition. It's that commitment. And it's absolutely about making spaces where women who have traditionally and almost globally been left behind, been excluded, been silenced, been rendered invisible, to say what they need to say and to be safe in saying it so there aren't consequences for them. Two women are unsafe if they challenge a status quo. So we have to create the spaces and the conditions in which they can do that.
I used to be a minister of mines and energy in South Africa. It's a very masculine industry. I would go on delegations with my director general, who was a man, for instance. And when people, I go into a country or into an industry, people will come and greet him first because they would expect that he is the minister. And then he would greet them and he would say, can I present my minister? And you could just see the embarrassment because they would just have made up their mind. If there was a man and a woman and this was about mining or about energy, it's got to be the man that is leading and is a leader in this situation. And then I would always use every platform I have to talk about the stereotypes that need to be deconstructed. And I think it is also the responsibility of our governments, of our leaders, to appoint women into these positions in which women are a rare breed in order to disrupt the notion on who belongs where. And making our governments uncomfortable is also about saying them, you know, women do not belong in social welfare. Women need to be a minister of defense, a minister of mines and those kinds of things. We have to continuously push the frontiers at every level.
Well, thank you for your thoughts on that. It's certainly encouraging, and I would certainly hope to wish you rejuvenation in your mission and to keep up the good work. I know it must be exhausting and challenging personally. So I do thank you on an international level for creating a women's collective that can address these issues and take these stands on behalf of all women. Across Canada, regionally, the treatment of women is so diverse. If you look at our missing and murdered Indigenous Women's Commission that we couldn't even get successfully accomplished under our last government, there is areas of disparity, gender violence, violence against women, and it's something that one neighbor could have a family where the women are the leaders of that family and are lauded and applauded and given every opportunity, where right next door somebody could be being abused or worse. So it's an interesting culture to study gender parity, but I will say ultimately there is no sacred space for women, and I think we could combat some of that. If we look at our mainstream media industries in Canada, the amount of images that are broadcast of women, women being raped, women being brutalized, sodomized, abused, it's an epidemic in our country, and these companies profit off these images, and our government then in turn makes taxes from these organizations who are propagating this horrendous imagery hour after hour, day after day in our country. Certainly, I'm most proud of the work that I've done in the NCRA, and I've met Gretchen over 10 years ago on that Women's Hands and Voices panel where we put in place a woman's constitution for this organization that allowed for safe spaces, that allowed for childcare. If a woman broadcaster wanted to participate, she had access to childcare through our policy. And this year, to answer to your concern, we've created a harassment policy and a grievance process, which is amazing because women in this country, we shrug it off, we laugh it off. We're discriminated against based on our gender all the time, and we have this amazing, gracious attitude towards it. And I would really love to see more sacred women's space, spaces by women and for women, which this country is sorely lacking.
If you have these problems in Canada, can you imagine what's happening in Pakistan, what's happening in Mali? That is also a reason for us to think about global sisterhood, because the challenges are truly universal. Women from different parts of the world have similar experience, slightly different and maybe context specific, but you can connect the dots most of the time. And it is only when women are able to work together that we are able to actually shake the system. And because our governments belong to a community of practice called the United Nations, they sign to agreements, they commit to do certain things. We all have a responsibility to hold them accountable, to make sure that they use the powers vested in them to actually make these changes. By us being here in Canada to engage with your government, it is about engaging with them about their place in the world. And there's a lot of possibility for Canada to be one of the countries that emerges as a leader in these issues through international development, through domestic policies and so on. And there's a lot of experience on the ground, people like yourselves who can make these contributions. And I'm hoping that you can make sure that whatever you are doing here, you have a mechanism to share it with other women and other like-minded people in other parts of the world. It is sorely needed, the sharing of this experience that you have here.
Also, as a young woman, one thing that I do experience quite often, and a lot of my other sisters, they experience this too, is what we call lateral violence. Lateral violence has kind of manifested itself inside our communities. The root reasons are evident. You know, colonial violence has really hurt us as Indigenous people, as Indigenous women. And I was wondering if you had any good examples of how we can not so much combat lateral violence, but how we can turn it into lateral love.
one of the most important things when you're dealing with these issues that are both systemic and intergenerational is actually to work with both men and women in this context, young and old, because the complexity of the issues means that we need a comprehensive response. It means that we need to work with the school system, where in many of our countries, our teachers are sometimes part of the problem, not part of the answer. So we have to make sure that the school system speaks the language that we are trying to promote, the language of love, of equality, of respect for everybody. We have to do this in our faith spaces where we worship, where people sometimes are strongly influenced by their faith. We have to do that in the workplace, where even our trade unions sometimes can be part of the problem, those that are supposed to represent and protect the interests of workers. We have to do it with and through our government, which has so much influence on us, but also we have to form organizations through which we can organize. We cannot stop talking about these things. In Portuguese, there is the slogan, a luta continua, the struggle continues, we just have not arrived. These struggles that we have inherited from the giants on whose shoulders we stand are still relevant today, maybe a little bit different, but also we must give ourselves time to celebrate some of the breakthroughs that we have so that we do not also beat ourselves so much that we're discouraged. We lack the energy to move to the next. We need to give ourselves a break and use the successes that we have to spare us on.
A couple of final things I want to say is we did touch upon how Canadian women seem to lay down and take the abuse. And I do think that's largely due to the way we view and perceive Canada as Canadian women. We see, it can't actually be abuse. It can't actually be discrimination. Canada is such a great country. This cannot be what it is. And it turns out to be just that. So I think the most important in that situation would be first education, then the abolition of fear. Because once we get past that initial, I'm so scared to say anything, this is like a small fish against the big corporation, the big fish, I can't do anything, I can't make a change. Once you get past that initial fear, that's when we can see the real change happen. I wanted to ask you, Fumzile, for your final thoughts. I also wanted to thank you for coming and being a part of this conversation with us.
Well, my final thought is that as broadcasters, as people who are in the radio space, which is the medium of communication, you are sitting on a gold mine. And it's a privilege for you to be in this, which means that therefore there's responsibility on you to use this medium to change the world. Some people will use the barrel of a gun to force their ideas on other people. You can use your spoken word to change, to reach, to influence. Every day when you stand in front of the microphone and you open your mouths, you must just know that this just could be the day when you change someone's life. Take the space. I think the world, by and large, is ready and need people like yourself. So go there and just make a difference.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. How I was taught, we don't have a word for goodbye in Anishinaabemowin. So what we say is Bamapi Goabmen. That means see you again and hope you are well.
Thank you. Thanks.
A special thanks goes out to the panel's producers, Gretchen King and Sarah Newton, in conjunction with CHUO 89.1 FM, and to participants, Fumzile Nlambo Nuka, Executive Director of UN Women, Perna Sen, Director of Policy for UN Women, Nikki Jean, and Gabrielle Fayon. This production was recorded on unceded and unsurrendered Algonquin territory, and it was an honor to share in this work.